The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ari Roth, director of the most innovative Jewish theater in the country, Theater J, in Washington, D.C. We'll also have a visit from our Mevinah on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, immigration was at the top of everybody's list of topics, thanks to the idiocy of the Arizona legislature and governor, and the passing of SB 1070, which makes it possible for law enforcement officers to stop anyone they think might be an illegal immigrant without any other probable cause. And you know what? This week, that topic is still at the top of people's agendas, so perhaps it's worthwhile putting a little light into an area that has been mostly heat so far. The language that much of the controversy swirls around is essentially a permission for state and local law enforcement personnel to stop anybody they think might not be a legal immigrant and ask for proof of citizenship. The policeman or state trooper or whatever officer it is doesn't need any other probable cause under the new law to stop a pedestrian or even a vehicle. Just, does he or she think you are a legal resident? If not, you can be stopped and asked for ID. If he or she isn't satisfied with your ID, you can and likely will be arrested. That is, you can be stopped because somebody thinks you might be illegally in the United States, and the officer is then mandated to check, within reason, your immigration status. Actually, if you don't have an ID, they don't really need a reason to check. They are basically mandated to check and arrest you. Oh, and there's another part to this measure. It specifies that a law enforcement officer without a warrant may arrest a person if the officer has probable cause to believe that person has committed any public offense that makes the person removable from the United States. You got that? In other words, if they think that you might not be a legal resident, and the onus is always on you to prove you are at any and all times, rather than on the police to have some concrete reason for thinking you might not be legal, then he or she should arrest you and take you to jail because you might have done something that'll get you kicked out of the U.S. Now, to be fair, in the grand scheme of things, this might not seem like the worst change in the world. Police having the right to stop anyone they think might not have proper ID documents on them. After all, don't you regularly carry your driver's license? Shouldn't everybody carry ID? Well, there are two issues that I see here. The first is that the idea of living in a democracy, a free country in which we are free of unreasonable search and seizure, as the Bill of Rights and the Constitution tell us, is one of the crucial elements of American liberty. There are countries in which you are constantly asked for documents without cause. We call them dictatorships. Places like North Korea, Syria, Iran, Cuba. Of course, when we Jews think of being asked for ID on the grounds we might not have the right documents on us, we flash on Nazi Germany, where the demand for identification was a constant weapon of the fascists who worked so hard to destroy us. So, this particular law directly contradicts our conception that we live in a free country, one in which one's ethnicity is not considered a crime. And there's nothing in this law, unfortunately, that prevents law enforcement professionals from stopping people based on how they look at any time. Frankly, I think it's a very, very bad idea to encourage authorities to extend their reach into new areas of quite likely abuse. The second objection to this SB 1070 thing, this approach to immigration reform by means of stereotyping, is economic. Here's a few small facts about the number of our country's workers who are undocumented in a few choice fields of economic endeavor. Farms and forestry, 52%. Construction, 26%. Cooks, 20%. Grounds maintenance workers, 25%. And so on. Now, those numbers are national numbers. Here in the Southwest, where I live and where this fabulous law was created, the percentage of undocumented workers is much higher. Much. So creating a kind of hostile climate for workers in a variety of industries, workers who create a fair amount of wealth for America, impresses this rabbinic observer as, well, you know, not good for business. Of course, with conventions reconsidering coming to Arizona now, and even the baseball All-Star game in 2011 deciding about skipping Phoenix, we might have less business to worry about anyway. In any case, as a rabbi, my perspective is really a Jewish one, particularly so on this question of how we are to treat immigrants. The Jewish perspective on immigration is almost universally accepting of the immigrant. Jewish law is oriented towards protecting immigrants. And we as Jews are powerfully instructed to empathize with the stranger who has come to live among us. In addition, Jewish tradition is sympathetically concerned with integrating every immigrant into the community he or she is joining. Nowhere in Judaism are we instructed to demonize the immigrant or subject them to restrictions we ourselves are unwilling to experience. So I guess our Jewish approach should be to support those who are working to overturn what is a mistaken approach to a societal problem. We do have an immigration issue to address seriously, but this new law is neither intelligent nor a comprehensive approach. And so to play us in this morning, as a continuing reminder of some of the Latino bases for Jewish life, here's the classic Sephardic song, Scalarica del Oro, The Little Ladder of Gold, as sung by Alberto Mizrahi in Ladino, that wonderful mix of medieval Spanish and Hebrew. That was the Sephardic song Scalarica del Oro, sung by Chazan Alberto Mizrahi. We truly hope our state of Arizona comes to its senses speedily and soon, and this immigration issue at the very least. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest this morning will be Ari Roth, director of Theater J in Washington, D.C., the most innovative Jewish theatrical program in the country. Find out what Jewish theater has in store when we come back on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Ari Roth. He's enjoying his 13th season as artistic director at Theater J in Washington, D.C., where together with a dedicated staff, he has produced more than 85 full theatrical productions, including 29 world premieres and many more workshop presentations. He's also a playwright. His work has been produced across the country as well as at his own Theater J. His plays have been nominated for 5 Helen Hayes Awards, including Best Resident Production, and 2 Charles A. MacArthur Awards. He's a 98 and 2003 recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Playwriting Grant, a 3-time winner of the Helen Eisner Award, a 2-time winner of the Avery Hopwood, 4-time recipient of commissions from the National Foundation for Jewish Culture, and a recipient of the Myrtle Wreath Award from Hadassah. From all of this, do you make a living?
Well, here I am at a JCC in Washington, D.C., and at a JCC, you can make a living and you can take a schwitz, and everything's nice.
Everything's good. Yeah. Tell me, is there a way to make theater Jewish?
Well, it's very hard to make theater un-Jewish, you might say. Jews have their imprint over American drama like no other ethnic group. I mean, Jewish drama helped forge the American theatrical sensibility, American Jewish nusach, the nigguns, the melodies from Gershwin through Tin Pan Alley and vaudeville to, you know, everything we hear on Broadway has been filtered through a Jewish ear, a Jewish lens. The American family drama owes as much to the American Jewish dinner table as to any other, cultural contribution.
Now, I think many of us familiar with the great American musical theater canon, and of course, all of the people you mentioned, and Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim and everybody, but we think about legitimate drama that is non-musical theater. Who do you think are the most prominent Jewish playwrights? Who do you like the best?
Well, our signature playwrights at Theater J, you might say our godfathers, begin with Clifford Odets, who really represents that bridge between an American vernacular and the Yiddish immigrant culture from which he came and which he wrote about so fluently in Awake and Sing and his right. 6 other plays.
Waiting for Lefty.
Waiting for Lefty, the original great labor play.
Right.
Paradise Lost and Golden Boy. And Rocket to the Moon, plays which we've done here at Theater J. And a decade after him, Arthur Miller comes along with All My Sons and Death of a Salesman and The Crucible and A View from the Bridge. And you might say these are crypto-Jewish works. We identify Miller and his theater of responsibility and his theater of ethics and morality as being a prophetic Jewish voice. Those are not necessarily Jewish characters you see in those particular plays. They emerge in The Price. They emerge in Broken Glass. They emerge in some of his other plays. Miller, as an assimilated Jewish prophet, makes his own indelible contribution both to Jewish culture and American theater history.
What a great phrase, assimilated Jewish prophet. We will talk much more about theater in America, his own work, and Jewish theatrical figures with Ari Roth, the artistic director of Theater J, when we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife Ann are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old, my wife is 86, and we like staying at Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo, they made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of
of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service, and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two-bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. We are now in the later weeks of the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Passover and Shavuot, the 7 weeks between the Festival of Freedom and the Festival of Covenant, when we receive the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. In about a week and a half, it'll be Shavuos. It begins the night of May 18th. In the spirit of preparing us for this Festival of Torah, here's a favorite cut from our house rock band, Avanim. Great peace of those who love the Torah. Shalom Rav, Leohavei Torah Techa.
Shalom.
Was Shalom Rav Leohavei Torah Techa from Avanim, Great Peace of Those Who Love the Torah. We welcome our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, happy Mother's Day.
Oh, and I am a happy mother.
I'm glad to hear that.
I am a proud and happy mother.
Amy, would you like to share?
It's so nice that you asked. Well, to be quite frank, I have weathered the teenage years, and I now can say on the other side, I have a lovely 22-year-old daughter and almost soon-to-be 25-year-old son, and have learned the, probably just like every parent, the hard way, how to do what parents need to do at this point of the parenting game, which is to keep your mouth shut. But that's not the Jewish view of parenting, because parents, for the most part, are deemed to be horim, teachers. We have a role, a very significant role, as both the givers of birth, We see ourselves actually in a sense in a triangle, that there are three different parents of each child, the mother, the father, and God. And so we are really in a working relationship with God and what is sacred to us when we try to do our best in raising our kids. The challenge, of course, is to be a teacher doesn't always mean to be a lecturer or to be someone who always acts as if they're in the know, because so much of parenting is to let your kids experience sometimes, while keeping our mouths shut, the struggles and difficulties of life and growing up, and not always intervene to rescue them before they've had a chance to figure out themselves what they need to do. So for this Mother's Day, I think I'd like to suggest that part of the art of parenting would be to continue on almost an annual or at least stage by stage basis for our children to evaluate what the role of being a teacher is to your kid and how best to effectively teach, sometimes verbally, sometimes by not speaking, the values and the lessons that you hope that your children will encounter and embrace in their lives.
So, on Mother's Day, if you had one value that you would like to impart to your children, what would it be?
Oh, I think that's such a great question. One value. I think the value would be to give and try to experience unconditional love.
Lovely. Thanks, Amy, and may you experience lots of unconditional love.
Oh, I'm feeling it. I'm feeling
the
vibe right now from you, Rabbi.
Good, good. It's all Ahava here, baby. Thanks, Amy. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
What a fabulous spring we've had here.
I'll tell you, this is a great time to be a chef. We're getting the most beautiful vegetables from our gardeners right now. Little fava beans, spring peas, little tiny delicate leeks. Great baby carrots with their little green tufts. All the herbs, and then the wild things from the sea. Unbelievable Alaskan wild halibut right now. Then we're getting spring lamb, and this is the time to be a chef, and this is the time to eat out.
And the time to eat at Janos, I would say. Best restaurant I can think of. What's the phone number?
615-6100. Rabbi, you can go to our website. All of our menus are on our website, and you can make reservations. Janos.com.
So that's JANOS.com. We will see you there for a great spring dining experience. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, it's getting kind of hot. Time to think about going away for the summer. As a Jewish tourist, where should we go this year?
It's a good question, and I'm afraid the discussion will go far beyond today's session. But as we do think about the summer and where to go, first of all, as I've said before on this very show, every place that was once part of the Ottoman Empire has a rich and interesting Jewish history. Some of those places are now easier to visit than others. I wouldn't recommend necessarily that your listeners consider planning a trip to Iraq in the immediate future.
Although, thank you, though.
Although I have a Jewish friend in the Foreign Service who was just slam dunked into a posting in the southwestern part of Iraq for 6 months, had to leave his wife and kids behind in the garden spot of Jakarta, Indonesia. And he's in Iraq, and he's terribly impressed by the quality of the job we're doing. And he believes firmly that we will leave that country with dignity and with deserved pride in our accomplishments. So,
please, God.
There are still some Jews there, and it is a place with obviously a rich Jewish history.
Unbelievable Jewish history.
Way back to before the Ottoman Empire. But in terms of the Ottomans as we normally think of them, all of southeastern Europe, all the Ladino-speaking Jewish communities of Sarajevo or Skopje or Thessaloniki or whatever, were all rich Ottoman communities. And there are many. You could do a trail around the Balkans and you couldn't begin to scratch the surface of the rich Jewish history in, let's say, just three countries. If you count all the former Yugoslavia as one country, it's now like 12, but if you conceive of it as one, Bulgaria and Greece, those three countries alone, you could spend 3 weeks on the trail of exciting Jewish history and increasingly also active, well-organized, well-conceived, very modern little Jewish museums are sprouting up all over in the wake of communist regimes, partially because the governments realize it's a way they can make money.
Because Jews like to travel and see Jewish sites wherever they
go. Well, and partially because local Jewish communities are exploring their own roots now that they're free to do so, and they're taking out documents and archives and family photos and looking for a place to preserve them. And they get funding from big-time philanthropists in the U.S. or Canada or England or France, many of whom have origins in these countries, but who no longer have active ties other than funding the construction and the ongoing operation of a tiny little Jewish museum in Thessaloniki or Dubrovnik or Skopje. It's very cool what's happening. It's not a major renaissance. I don't want to exaggerate, but you can find easily traces of a rich and colorful Jewish history in these countries. And then all the way across North Africa. Now I notice tours to Libya are starting to pick up. Well, again, I'm not going to suggest that your listeners plan a trip to Libya for this summer, but Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, all have rich Jewish histories. And in fact, all have current Jewish communities, which can provide the traveler with kosher food or a place to say Kaddish or a minyan, whatever people need is available there. So there's really a wide choice just within the former territories of the Ottoman Empire. And maybe we can talk about other parts of the world next week.
Thanks, Tom. We will. I have to say also some of those synagogues in these communities are utterly gorgeous and extraordinarily different from what we're used to in the United States.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Great.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Leah and Sarah, old friends who haven't seen each other in a while, meet in the market. They've both been married to their husbands for a long time. "No, how are things with you, Sarah?" asks Leah. "Not too good," Sarah replies. "I'm feeling very badly. I don't think Abe finds me attractive anymore." "Why? How do you know this?" asks Leah. "Because as I get older," replies Sarah, "he bothers less and less to even look at me. When I was younger, he couldn't take his eyes off of me." "I feel so sorry for you, Leah. The truth is, as I get older, my David says I get more and more beautiful each day." "Yes," replies Sarah, "but don't forget, David is an antique dealer." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. You know, an antique, really. A special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. Another Chelm story this week. This one, too, like the first Chelm story I told, was collected by Joel Ben Izzy. Now, in Chelm, it happened that one day an argument broke out. And this often happened in Chelm. It was a town of fools who all thought that they were rather wise. They all thought they knew what was what. And so when one person made a certain assertion, the other person would start arguing. And before you knew it, the entire town was just up in arms, one half against the other half. And the occasion this time was an argument over celestial lights. Someone had been talking about the sun. He claimed it was the most important light in the heavens. And someone looked at him like he was crazy and said, no, clearly the most important light is the moon. And this just escalated until soon parents were fighting with their children, spouses were fighting with each other, friends were fighting with each other, everyone was fighting with each other. And finally, they decided that enough was enough. They would bring the matter to their great, wise rabbi, and he would have the final word. And so they all gathered at his home, and they told the rabbi their contention. The sun is better. No, the moon is better. And the rabbi, he stroked his long rabbinic beard, and he thought about it for a moment, and he said, "Well, I agree that the sun is very important. I have to admit that I think it is the moon that is the most important." And everyone, they looked at him and they said, why, what's the reason? And the rabbi said, "Well, it's obvious, isn't it? You see, the moon, it shines in the sky. It gives us light while it is dark outside. Whereas the sun, it gives us light only during the day when there's already plenty of light." And so ended another argument in Chelm.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its name for the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of our portion. Superficially, it's just a list of names and numbers, not a very interesting text for study or inspiration, but it also teaches a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes, and should similarly count in our eyes as well. The notion that every human being matters is part of our tradition in many ways, from the requirement that we have 10 Jewish adults for a minyan, to the obligation that we must view every other person as a tzelem Elohim, an image of God, no different from ourselves in holiness. The Talmud tells us that somebody who saves one single life is accorded the merit of having saved an entire world. Each of us is counted because we all count. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of sanctity. When we do the tabulation that lets us know we have the 10 required for a minyan, traditionally we don't count by numbers, since that would devalue each human being into a mere digit. Instead, we find a verse from the Bible that has 10 words, and work our way through it until we've completed the passage, thus making every member of that accounting into part of a holy sentence. In a world of numbers, it's comforting to realize that we are each much more than the sum of our parts. No matter how we seek to quantify and digitize our world, each one of us, including you, matters to God. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and learn from Ari Roth of Theater J just what it is that makes a play Jewish. All that when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Obama capped an intensive 2 weeks of administration make nice with Israeli officials and the American Jewish community by hosting Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Peace Laureate and Holocaust memoirist, for lunch at the White House last week. It was a good kosher lunch, was the first thing Wiesel pronounced. Wiesel, of course, a former guest of Two Jewish. There were moments of tension, he said, but the tension, I think, is gone, which is good. This echoed Ehud Barak, Israeli defense minister, who a few days earlier told leaders of the American Jewish Committee that the slight disagreements between Israel and the United States are behind us. The tension and slight disagreements, of course, were between the United States and the government of Israel, and by extension, the mainstream pro-Israel community in America. They started back on March 8th, when Israel announced a major housing start in East Jerusalem during a visit by Vice President Joe Biden. Biden rebuked Israel, but it didn't stop there. Next, there was an extended dressing down from Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, phoned in to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and claims by Clinton and other U.S. officials that Israel insulted Biden. Well, you know, to tell you the truth, they did, but okay. Then, when Netanyahu arrived in Washington to address the annual American-Israel Public Affairs Committee conference, APAC, Obama all but snubbed the Israeli leader, agreeing only to meet with him without photo ops. In private, Jewish organizational leaders reached out to White House friends and said that the White House needed to explain its issues privately before tensions moved into the status of a full-fledged crisis in American-Israeli relations. There were signs of that, by the way, real ones, with messages about the dangers of pressing Israel too hard on Jerusalem. The author of one of the messages, in the form of a full-page New York Times ad, was none other than Elie Wiesel. The Obama administration initiative, since then, has focused on emphasizing the many areas of cooperation between Israel and the U.S., including work on opposing Iranian nuclear development and the Israeli-American military cooperation efforts. Well, it seems to be working. Tensions may very well be easing across the board between the Obama administration and Israel. Thank goodness. In other news, Alan Dershowitz reportedly turned down an offer to serve as Israel's ambassador to the UN. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman assiduously courted the well-known Jewish-American lawyer, but Dershowitz refused. If he had accepted Israel's most senior diplomatic post, Dershowitz, who is 72 years old, would have had to make aliyah to Israel. He teaches at Harvard and is a prominent advocate for Israel in the United States. Israel's current ambassador to the UN, Gabriela Shalev, will complete her two-year term at the end of August and has said she will return to Israel and continue her academic work, whether or not a new ambassador has been named. Well, this whole Dershowitz thing reminds me of Israel's occasional efforts to engage non-Israeli Jews in key leadership positions. Currently, Stanley Fisher, who spent most of his career as head of the World Bank and at Citigroup, and was Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's thesis advisor many years ago. Anyway, Stanley Fisher is now the governor of the Bank of Israel and perhaps the key player in the successful Israeli economy. And most famously, back in 1948, the first presidency of Israel was offered to Albert Einstein, who declined it in favor of Chaim Weizmann. In South Africa, La Affaire Bar Mitzvah Goldstone took another turn. A delegation of senior South African Jewish communal leaders met with Judge Richard Goldstone to discuss his participation in the 2009 UN fact-finding mission into the Gaza War. The meeting was held as part of a deal brokered between the South African Zionist Federation and Goldstone, which allowed the judge to attend his grandson's Bar Mitzvah on May 1st in the absence of threatened protests. Goldstone now lives in the United States. He initially said he would not attend the Bar Mitzvah, and we reported that on Too Jewish. Oops. We believed Goldstone. My bad. Anyway, the Goldstone report accused Israel and Hamas of war crimes and possible crimes against humanity. In the meeting with Jewish community leaders, Goldstone said he had spent much of his professional life championing international criminal justice, and it would have been hypocritical for me to continue to speak out against violations of international law and impunity for war crimes around the world, but remain silent when it came to Israel simply because I am Jewish. Well, he surely didn't do that. Goldstone noted that it was the first time the UN Human Rights Council had actually offered Israel an opportunity to tell its story to a UN inquiry, and said he hoped it might herald a new approach by the council. But sadly for everyone, the Israeli government squandered that opportunity, Goldstone said. Had Israel provided us with credible information to respond to the allegations we received, they would have been given appropriate consideration and could potentially have influenced our findings. We're not so sure about that. In his statement, South African Zionist Federation Chairman Avram Krengel said, "We have deep disappointment and dissatisfaction with your involvement as a South African Jew in leading the UN fact-finding mission on the Gaza conflict." He referred to glaring disparities in the way the parties were treated by the mission. Krengel said certain aspects of the report were highly prejudicial to Israel while being extremely favorable toward Hamas. He added that without Goldstone's credentials as a Jew and preeminent human rights jurist, the report would have lacked all credibility and would have failed to gain any traction. Well, that's certainly true. But I am beginning to wonder now if Israel could have, and perhaps should have, provided more information to Goldstone during the investigation, however politicized it was. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Ari Roth, enjoying his 13th season as artistic director at Theater J in Washington, D.C. He has produced more than 85 full theatrical productions, 29 world premieres, many more workshop presentations. His own plays have been nominated for and received a host of awards. He was recently named to the Forward 50 as one of the 50 most prominent national men and women leading American Jewish community into the 21st century. So is your family proud of that?
Well, you know, the next on that list was Bernie Madoff. So, you know, it didn't necessarily mean they were well-liked. They just made, you know, they did some damage or they had an impact.
Yeah,
so.
as Willie Loman says, he was liked but not well-liked.
Right.
You mentioned
my parents have been sending opening night flowers for 8 times a year since 1997. So they haven't missed a show for opening night flowers.
Kinahara.
So I think that they're proud.
You know what they really should do is invest in a florist. In
I think they have. Right.
So we've talked a little bit about some of the godfathers of Jewish American playwrights, Clifford Odets, Arthur Miller. I know David Mamet comes to mind in this generation. When did Jews writing for the theater begin to feel comfortable writing more openly and a little less crypto-Jewish about their figures?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I guess you could say that the 60s become a watershed. Maybe it's Paddy Chayefsky's The Tenth Man. But, you know, there's a great editor, a scholar of American Jewish drama named Ellen Schiff, and she has three volumes of American Jewish plays. I recommend them highly to you because you obviously know your stuff, and your listeners probably do. She has a book of 10 Jewish plays, one from each decade, and it's called Awake and Singing. Plays from the American Jewish repertoire, and there's a very, very long description in that book as well about just what is American Jewish drama, and you know, what do we mean when we say it. And then she goes on to look at more contemporary work, and she really picks up speed, people identifying openly as Jewish writers, and it's a book called Fruitful and Multiplying. And then beyond that, through the National Foundation for Jewish Culture, she and another wonderful professor, Michael Posnick, have a volume called 9 Contemporary Jewish Plays. So you begin to see a proliferation of theaters like Theater J, what we would call Jewish theaters, not Yiddish-based theaters, but plays that celebrate the Jewish contribution to drama, whether it's American Jewish or world Jewish voices. And you see organizations, the Council of Jewish Theaters, which then becomes the Association for Jewish Theaters. This all picks up, you know, from the 70s into the 80s. And AJT, and you in Arizona have the Arizona Jewish Theater.
We do, in fact.
And Janet Arnold, who runs it, it's a spirited organization and part of this Association for Jewish Theaters. So you have not only writers writing for openly and identifying themselves as Jews, but you have these theaters establishing different kinds of repertoires. Some focus more on comedic and family elements, other on musicals, and of course there are others like Theater J that specialize both in new work and thought-provoking work that wants to hold up a mirror to many of the social and political realities of our time.
How do you find the inspiration for your own plays? Where do you look? Or do you look, or do they just kind of come
to you? Well, you look at what sticks in your craw. You look for problems. and you hope to resolve, you hope to negotiate the problems through the form that is uniquely given to theater to dispute, you know, to hold these Talmudic disputations. So Jews are good at theater because they have it in their bloodstream, you know, handed down through the generations to be disputatious, to present a thesis and then an antithesis. You have a protagonist and you have an antagonist within these narratives that present problems for our time, as you might say, responsa, that is put into action. And you, so for me, when I don't know what I think, or when I know, you don't, when I'm confused about something, but I know that I feel deeply about it, I know that the drama is a place in which I can argue it out and hopefully push through to a resolution.
You know, it reminds me of a comment about Rashi, the greatest Torah commentator from the Middle Ages. Really, what he does is he looks at a text and he says, what's wrong with it? And in a way, as Jews, we look at life that way. What's wrong and how can it be fixed?
And, you know, Rashi, what an extraordinary biblical, you know, scholar. And so who would accuse him of being, you know, an apostate or being contrary or being negative, you know, too negative, poor Rashi, for asking that question, what's wrong with it? Sometimes you say, what's wrong with it? Just like a mother would say, yeah, I don't like that tie. But what they really mean is, I love the way you look. Couldn't you just improve a little bit? Or I love everything about you except for this one little thing. And that's actually a very endearing kind of engagement, and you want to finish off the work of creation in a way. So I think you know, Jewish drama has a role, just like in Rashi, of saying, what's wrong with this picture, even though everybody seems happy and everything, things seems fine.
Moving into some of your professional work, you know, creating a really dynamic center, you know, in a Jewish public space in a J to do theater, that used to be common. I remember my mom directing drama teens in, you know, the West Side Jewish Community Center in Los Angeles years ago. A lot of those programs have withered. How do you make yours so dynamic, and how can other people follow that lead?
Well, it requires a lot of bridge building. I think you have to recognize that it takes a village, it takes a board, it takes a dedicated community with a stated and understood mandate that art matters. And, you know, within our Jewish community, the larger Klal Yisrael, we've got people who support the arts and believe in the enduring value of arts. But we also, within our community, we have other people who think the arts is third-tier priority. And within the realm of what the Jewish community should support and pay attention to, the arts are negligible. Let somebody else worry about the arts. And so what we have here, and it may be a unique factor in that this JCC in Washington, D.C., is relatively younger than its senior partner in Rockville, Maryland, in the suburban JCC, which actually grew out of the old historic Washington, D.C. JCC, which shut its doors in the mid-60s during the period of white flight and the whole urban turbulence of the time. The Jewish community moved to the suburbs and invested in a suburban JCC. It was not until the late 80s that the Jewish community reincorporated here in the district, and then they bought back this old historic building. There was a return to the urban roots in Washington, D.C., and at the center of this historic JCC, which was being rededicated and refurbished in 1997, at the center was not a swimming pool and was not, you know, five basketball courts. It was a theater. It was a theater space, the Aaron and Cecile Goldman Theater. And, yeah, we have a three-quarter length basketball court, and we have a three-quarter size swimming pool. We got a great preschool. But at the heart of this center is a performing arts space. And it's a performing arts space that's outfitted professionally to the max. It's not some multi-purpose room with, you know, risers that you, and you have a ballet class in the day, and then you have a movie at night, and then you do a theater on the weekends. It's much, you know, it's optimized to do superior theatrical presentations, to state-of-the-art film presentations when it's the Jewish Film Festival. And we just don't do ballet classes. You know, that can happen somewhere else. So people really invested in the arts. We get a lot of fundraising dollars, both from national foundations like the Schubert Foundation and the NEA, but we also have the Jewish community that's proud of what we do. We recognize these are hard times, and there are indeed many, many priorities, and there is a dwindling pool of resources. But people believe that the finest arts need to flourish in these difficult times. And, you know, we've adapted to the changing times. We have become ever more eclectic in what we produce. We believe the theater should be for everybody. We're not a snobby elitist theater. We're not too proud to do Neil Simon. And we do him happily, and he does extremely well for us. But at the same time, we do a David Mamet. We do what you might say is the new David Mamet, the David Mamet you haven't heard of yet. And we do the sister of David Mamet you haven't heard of yet. We like to introduce a lot of strong female voices, too.
The just time for one more question, and I think we could go on a long time. Theater is a rich, and Jewish theater is a very vibrant world. You've written a number of plays. This is a terrible question to ask you, but what's your favorite, and can you give us a synopsis?
Well, the play I've been, that will be, happen in New York next year in one shape or form or another is a two-play cycle, and it's my favorite because I can't let it go. I'd started writing it a long time ago. It's called Born Guilty, Interviews with Children of Nazis. It's based on the book by Peter Sikorsky, an Austrian Jewish journalist. And Born Guilty has been done in many, many cities and in many countries, and it's published by Samuel French. Peter Sikorsky is an Austrian Jewish journalist who then confounded the Jewish community of Austria and indeed much of Europe in general when he joined forces with Jörg Haider, the far-right-wing populist leader of the Freedom Party. And Peter Sikorsky joined the European Parliament as a member of the Freedom Party, a Jewish apologist for the son of a Nazi who said some really, really outrageous things.
Anti-Semitic things, and certainly anti-Zionist things. Hater.
Indeed. Both. And so the sequel that I wrote, is called The Wolf in Peter, is about Peter Sikorsky's slide over to the dark side. Indeed, what turned out to be a temporary slide, a midlife crisis kind of flirtation with the people and with a figure that he had once excoriated in the press. And the play examines anti-Semitism in Europe today and the politics of anti-foreigner rhetoric and an attempt by an American to set Peter straight, to rescue Peter from the drift and to for him to sort of recover the values that were important.
Should we expect a trilogy?
Well, I'll stick to a diptych right now because we've produced these plays in three cities as plays in repertory, one then another, but that's proved to be cumbersome. So right now what we're trying to do with the Epic Theater is create a singular evening. We did an evening in February, both plays together, cutting them both down a little bit, and it was like watching a thrilling motion picture. So the idea is to create this diptych, this Born Guilty cycle, and hopefully that's a play that you'd see in New York and you'll do in Arizona one day.
God willing. Ari, where can people go to find out more about your plays?
Well, theaterj.org, that's T-H-E-A-T-E-R, and the letter J.org. We're thrilled. We're doing a play called In Darfur for the next 3 weeks, which is all about the conflict, the unfolding genocide in Darfur. And then we have this terrific hit play from Israel called Mikveh, by Hadar Galron, 8 women in a Jewish ritual bath in Israel. And that's part of a festival called Voices from a Changing Middle East, this year focusing on Kol Isha, or Voice of the Woman.
Fascinating. It sounds great. If anybody's in D.C. anytime soon, go look up Theater J. I want to thank Ari Roth for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest. Get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Rabbi Mark Gopin, founder of A New Way to Resolve Conflict and International Disputes and head of a Center on Conflict Analysis and Resolution. My friends, this week marks the 43rd anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem, and on Wednesday we'll celebrate with Yom Yerushalayim. In honor of that, our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes from singer Shuli Natan, the immortal Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold. Have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Avir Harim Tzalul Kaya.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.